And our sermon text today is Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 13, through chapter 7 and verse 10. Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O noble daughter. Your rounded thighs are like jewels, the work of a master hand. Your navel is a rounded bowl that never lacks mixed wine. Your belly is a heap of wheat encircled with lilies. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are pools in Heshbon. By the gate of Bath-Rabim, your nose is like a tower of Lebanon which looks toward Damascus. Your head crowns you like Carmel, and your flowing locks are like purple. A king is held captive in the tresses. How beautiful and pleasant you are, O loved one, with all your delights. Your stature is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I say, I will climb the palm tree and lay hold of its fruit. Oh, may your breast be like clusters of the vine, and the scent of your breath like apples, and your mouth like the best wine. It goes down smoothly for my beloved, gliding over lips and teeth. I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me. Once more, in our text today, one of the great rock and roll themes is return, come back. We've been seeing the parallels between harem life and rock and roll culture in these last few weeks. Ray Charles sings an old blues ballad recorded in 1957. The lyrics go, "Oh, come back, baby. Oh, mama, please don't go. 'Cause the way I love you, you'll never know. Come back, baby. Yeah, yeah. Let's talk it over one more time. Come back. Return." And songs with almost the exact same title but a variety of lyrics festoon the catalog of rock and roll hits over the decades. We know. We've grown up with them, right? The Ramones, Player, Buddy Holly all had songs with the same theme but different lyrics and melody. It's a recurring theme in all music, really, and poetry, precisely because it is a recurring theme in life. Return. You've left. Where have you gone? Lovers leave their beloved, and the one left behind pines and aches and longs for the one who left. They call out to the one leaving. They plead with them. They want them to come back, to return. People of the 9th and 10th century BC were not immune to the very same feelings. The idea of coming back or returning was one felt by Solomon and his harem as they saw Shulamith leave them and go back to her village, to her mother, the room of her mother, as the metaphor is called, and the shepherd boy. And she leaves with an implicit rejection of Solomon and his harem life that beckoned her. And it's borne out for us in our text today. Let's look to our text today, shall we? Inside flap of your bulletin, you'll have a three-point outline with which you can follow our progress. You won't have to wait to hear the words "in conclusion" because you'll be following along in the outline, okay? Our first point, taken from verse 13, we're in Solomon's third temptation. His temptation of Shulamith to join his harem. Solomon's third temptation. The harem girls importuned Shulamith to return to Solomon. Return, O Shulamite. Last week, we saw the Shulamite girl flee the harem after the second round of flattery Solomon, who kind of threw out that flattery like a net is cast in the water to snare a trophy fish. Yet that second temptation differed very little from the first, even to the repetition we saw. We compared the two temptations, repeating words and phrasings such that it was easy to recognize it for what it was. And Shulamith found it possible to get away without succumbing to the seductive siren song of Solomon and his appeal to her to join the harem. How beautiful she was, coming in from the country, and that harem could refine her and bring her up to speed such that he would be adequate for his bed. How difficult it is to resist such persuasive flattery, especially when you know that most of what the seducer is saying about you is true. We saw that that's the power of a skilled seducer. He employs the truth to lure his victim to follow a lie. Who was it who said, the Lord knows that in the day you eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall become as gods, knowing good and evil. Well, Adam and Eve sure knew good and evil by the time they were done falling, right? Even in tempting Jesus, who was it who said, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone. Surely all of that was true, but meant to seduce. And as we will see, Solomon is not done with seducing. He will employ one last round of flattery to Shulamith, as do the harem girls here, and their call to her to return. Return, O Shulamites. This is an important juncture in the song because of all the double entendres and, in fact, the nickname that we have picked up for our shepherd girl, Shulamith. We've been calling her that all through our series. But these really are the only verses where this descriptive word is used. Shulamite. Shulamite is really more of an adjective than it is a proper name. In the book, as I've been trying to underline with you, we're never given her name per se. Solomon is the only proper name given in the whole song. And Shulamite is not a region, or it's not a tribe in Israel, or it's not a family name. Rather, it is a feminized form of the name Solomon. We've described this before, those of you that are new to this series. The name Shulamite, or Shulamith, is a feminized form of the name Solomon, a deliberate pun used by the harem girls to poke fun at her as being wiser than thou. The consonants for Solomon are the same here in her name, but with differing vowels, such that we pronounce it Shulamith or Shulamite instead of Solomon. We see examples of this in English. I've put the spotlight on Alan and his daughter Alana, right, who is a feminized name of the form Alan. Now we, perhaps this is the first time you've heard this, Rachel, but your mother and I toyed with naming you Davida at one point. I'm sure you're grateful that we didn't, that we named you Rachel. But that's the sense of the feminization of the consonants for Solomon being Shulamith or Shulamite. So, strictly speaking, what the others, some of you see that, just take an eraser and erase that others out of there, right? That's not part of the text. That is a commentary made by translators, speculation. These are not others. This is the harem speaking. What the harem is doing is calling her a pejorative, sarcastic name. That is the female equivalent of Solomon, since she finds it wiser to return to her home, to her mother's room, and to her shepherd boy. then stay in Jerusalem as a daughter of Jerusalem and enjoy the rock and roll luxury of harem life. Consult previous sermons to see what I mean by the rock and roll lifestyle of the harem, of harem life, because there's a lot of parallels between it and our contemporary culture. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Flee sexual immorality, Paul exhorts. And that is, in essence, precisely what our beautiful shepherd girl is doing. And the harem, instead of congratulating her and blessing her on her way, call out to her to return, return, but in terms laden with sarcasm. They intend to mock her with the adjective Shulamite. But we, especially as the church now, we take it up as a badge of honor, because she is actually wiser than Solomon in this matter. Nicknamed after Solomon, but indeed enjoying much more wisdom, at least in this stage in Solomon's life, than him. We see this all the time. Pejorative names often stick, don't they, to the exasperation of opponents. Tea Party, right? Derisively used by progressives. We embrace that. The name Christian was a pejorative, first used in Antioch. But it came to stick and later used with respect and affection. The followers of John Wesley were first mocked at the very methodical approach to Christian discipleship that Wesley took. And they were derisively referred to as Methodists. Well, until that method began to work very effectively in many people's lives. And the name stuck with respect and affection. One of my favorite stories is of one of my heroes, William F. Buckley, Jr., creator and editor of National Review. He was that lone intellectual voice for a while of American conservatism in the radical, crazy days of the 60s. Some of you gray hairs may remember him. But he was also a conservative, believing Christian who was not shy about his faith either. This is reflected in his biography. He tells the story of speaking of Christ at fancy dinner parties in D.C., the District of Criminals, and getting looks and comments of disdain and disgust for doing so. He became derisively known as a Christer, not Christian. They were all Christians because they went to church, you know, and they were all baptized. They were all Christians, right? But he was a Christer because he spoke of Christ all the time. And he became a social outcast in liberal progressive circles. But he was determined to wear that title, Christer, as a badge of honor. Some examples. And the harem girls used Shulamith in this precise way. You think, simple, beautiful shepherd girl, that you're wiser than Solomon? How can you refuse him and the world that he offers you, the rock and roll lifestyle that he offers you? Look, by giving yourself and your virginity to the king, you not only get the prestige and pleasure of sleeping with the Elvis of our generation, and then thereafter a life of ease and luxury in the palace harem for the rest of your life. Isn't that really smart? Isn't going back to your poor, dirty little backward village and your shepherd boy, isn't that really dumb? But we have seen her choice. We have seen her choice, a godly choice, to honor the biblical model of one man, one woman marriage, as consistently given from Genesis. A man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, that's singular, and they shall become one flesh. We saw the incident with Abimelech, too, and Sarah, reflecting on the nature, the sinful nature of polygamy and Abimelech's harem. So we see this model, biblical model of one man, one woman marriage from Genesis all the way to Revelation. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. That this indeed is a wise choice. Shulamith is consistent with Genesis and Revelation. Shulamith is consistent with the Proverbs woman. Once again, we see in the canon the closing of Proverbs, Proverbs 31 woman. Who can find a virtuous woman? Which is then detailed. Then we have the book of Ruth, who is, wonder of wonder, what a coincidence, a virtuous woman as described in Proverbs 31. And then comes Song of Solomon, where we see Shulamith, who is, what a coincidence, a virtuous woman, a la Proverbs 31. A wise choice she is making. She is a model of the one of whom Solomon asks, a virtuous woman who can find. And as we'll see in several weeks, in her concluding reflections on what wisdom she has garnished from her experience, she will reflect in chapter 8, if you want to turn over there a minute, as you have your Bibles in your hands. You'll see verses 6 and 7, some of the kernel of the wisdom that she has garnished from her experience. She will reflect that, first of all, love is rock solid. The language used there is strong as death. Fierce as the grave. That true biblical love is white hot. Flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord, she says. And that true biblical love endures all trials. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. And she has just been through the flood. She has been through the storms. I give credit to Dr. Miles Van Pelt for that language. Love is rock solid, white hot, and endures all trials. Dr. Van Pelt, I think, really does understand Song of Solomon very well. Many floods have tried to drown her love, but to no avail. And the name used to mock her, we take up as a badge of honor too. And Solomon deliberately uses this name ironically, because she is indeed wiser than him in this matter. Now, there is an ironic use of the theme of returning as well. Return, return. It is called a broad motif in the Bible, the shuv motif. Scholars call it. Shuv is Hebrew for return. All the way, once again, from the Pentateuch to the prophets, the shuv motif appears. For example, we read that today. When Israel strays from God, she is exhorted to shuv, to return. Return, faithless Israel, declares the Lord. I will not look on you in anger, for I am merciful, declares the Lord. We read that in our Old Testament reading this morning. Now, there's irony here. There's a double-edged tone to this. We're looking at Hebrew poetry, by the way. This is not narrative. This is Hebrew poetry. And once again, most difficult genre in any language is poetry. But we have to stick with the genre here. The harem girls are calling her to return. Return, right? Which is a foolish choice. While she is in the midst of her return to her village, to her mother's room and her shepherd boy, which is a wise choice. Consequently, Shulamith is aptly named, once again, ironically, because she is wiser than Solomon. And so we embrace this sarcastic name given in sarcasm. We embrace her as Shulamith. We embrace that name with a badge of honor. It's her nickname. In fact, the text does indicate for us that she has had an effect upon the harem itself. The second part of verse 13, poetry. Once again, for many interpreters, we don't know what this means, right? Well, in this context, it indicates that she has had an effect upon the harem itself. The harem itself is divided as to who is wise in reality. That's the upshot of the second part of this verse. Why should you look upon the Shulamite as upon a dance before two armies? Ignore the superscription he again. It's annoying. These superscriptions are annoying. It's not a he. This is a voice that comes up from the harem, questioning the motive for some of the harem girls to have a return. The dance before two armies is a poetic way of saying that the harem is now divided into two camps. One vying for the traditional, quote-unquote, view of the harem as a good thing, and another camp awakened by the adjurations of Shulamith, questioning whether she might actually be right. And if she were to return to the harem, the dance would continue. The two armies would still be lined up in confrontation and contention. This is a song. Remember again, this is a song, a poem. And by metaphor, we are told implicitly that her adjuration do not awaken love until it is ready. Remember, that's our word. Four adjurations throughout this book, and they all mark off major sections of the book. And the adjuration do not awaken love until it is ready. That is, until all the stage is set for biblical marriage. Her adjuration has found swearers in the harem itself. Remember, she puts them under adjuration and says, swear or betray. Those are the only two options you have. Swear or betray. Some have sworn her adjuration. The conflict between corrupt, decadent rock and roll harem life and traditional marriage is now engaged. As if gazing upon a dance before two armies. Shulamith has been dancing, if you will, metaphorically, before these two armies. And I would submit to you that this is the only coherent explanation of this verse. All other commentators, especially allegorical, the allegorical interpretation. I understand desiring to find Christ in the text here. And desiring to, maybe you're a little uncomfortable with some of the language, the erotic, sensual language that is used in this book too. And you're kind of eager, you're uncomfortable with this book for a variety of reasons, and you just want to see me get it over with and move on to something else. Well, reflect on why that may be. Reflect on why that may be for a while, because Christ is in this text, but we don't have to aggressively butcher the text to find him there and distort the text to find him there. The only coherent explanation of this verse and others I would submit to you, only by positing the harem as the context for the Song of Solomon, and positing a third member of a love triad, not just Shulamith and Solomon, but a third member in context, it fits very well too, the shepherd boy. As Shulamith's true biblical love, only this makes sense of the Song of Solomon. Some of you are coming around to that. All other views are incoherent as far as I'm concerned. The harem pleads for her to return. Return. But they are also conflicted, right? What about Solomon? What about Solomon? Well, that brings us to point two. Point two from verses 1 in chapter 7 through 9a. Solomon's third temptation. Solomon importunes Shulamith with one last round of flattery. One last round of flattery. Chapter 7, verse 1 through verse 9a. Now, some think that this last battery of flattery is from the harem itself. Others think it is Solomon. There's good points on both sides. While I see the point of the former, I tend to go with the latter. This is Solomon's voice. It is his last, more creative attempt to charm and seduce. Once more, there's a double edge to this sword of poetry here, too. Everything he says about her is true. She's all of these things. Parenthetically, we can use this as great biblical love poetry, too, with our spouses. And while not speaking allegorically about Christ and the church, we may certainly say with Paul that biblical marriage does indeed speak to the mystery of Christ and the church. The love, the affection, the beauty of the relationship of Christ and the church is like that of a bride and bridegroom. So that's there. But the design of the poem in Solomon's mouth is to seduce Shulamith from her one man, one woman commitment to his harem. It is as much a competition of worldview. Let me put this before you. It is as much a competition of worldview as it is an attempt to bed a beautiful woman. There are now two armies in the harem. For Solomon, it's important to maintain good order and discipline there, of all places. Anyone familiar with the history of polygamy, we've seen a bit of it when we look at Abimelech and Abraham and Sarah this morning. Anyone familiar with the history of polygamy knows that the culture of competing affections creates tensions and conflicts that often breaks out in warfare, breaks up households and kingdoms. We have that in some of the histories of the harems under Islamic caliphs. And so, for political and strategic reasons, it is imperative for Solomon to persuade her to return. And Solomon begins his systematic description of her physical beauty, this time working his way from the feet to the head instead of head to toe. The sandaled feet were considered flattering, which are also graceful and beautiful. Thighs like jewels, goes on to describe her. He has nice legs, as we might say today. A navel like a rounded goblet, belly like a heap of wheat. The taste was more Rubenesque in those days. Not a cut six-pack like today, right? Two breasts like two fawns. We've seen this repeated now a third time. Neck like an ivory tower. Eyes like pools of Heshbon. They were deep and still. That was a metaphor for being thoughtful and meditative. Indeed, we've seen her to be precisely that. Nose like a tower of Lebanon. That may not seem flattering at first, right? But the sense is it was aquiline. The Tower of Lebanon, referring to the white cliffs that oversaw, were just to the north then of Syria. A head that crowns her like Carmel, purple locks that hold the king captive, a reference here to that deep, dark black hair that is almost purple in certain lights, very lustrous head of hair that just captures Solomon. And he summarizes her beauty, and he is determined to take his pleasure with her, too. Well, all of these things may be well and good and be true of her. And indeed, someone is intended to do what Solomon intends to do with her. But will it be him? Well, she answers. That brings us to point three. Solomon's third temptation. From chapter 7, verses 9b through 10. With a sense of finality, Shulamith turns Solomon's words back on him. There's a great strategic move that he makes here. The sweet smell of her breath, the intimate taste of her mouth, is like wine. But he will never know it. Grammatically, the emphasis is on beloved, her beloved. And as we have consistently seen, her beloved is the shepherd boy. Only one will know the pleasures of her love, the beloved. And despite the 700 wives and 300 concubines that Solomon has tasted as king, Shulamith will not be among them. She is returning. Return, return. Certainly, return, return. But she is returning home. She is going home. The game is over. To put a big black period on her point, she alludes to her adjuration. Remember what her adjuration is, repeated four times. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. Her witnesses are the gazelles and the does, right? By the gazelles or the does of the field, innocent creatures. They are her witnesses. O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you not stir up or awaken love until it pleases, or desire, a synonym used there. She reaffirms the exclusivity of the one man, one woman relationship. I am my beloved's, i.e. the shepherd boy, and his desire, that is, that love, that pleasure, is me, right? His desire is for me. Love is not to be awakened until it pleases. That is, that's the poetic way of saying that true biblical love is awakened within the context of one man, one woman bond, sealed within the context of home and family. The kinds of intimacies and love banter, we've seen this all through the book. Perhaps it's been embarrassing and uncomfortable for some of you as we've gone through it. And I've encouraged you to talk with your children, especially, and brief them. This is a good time to have the talk, maybe, you know, within a biblical context. The poetic way of saying here all throughout this book, that true biblical love is awakened within the context of a one-man, one-woman bond, sealed within the context of home and family. We've seen that. Two allusions now to the idea of the mother's room, right? Which is a metaphor as well. Double entendre there for her womb, too. Productive. This kind of love is, how productive could a harem life be, right? Maybe there are babies born in the harem, but not families and children with families with a mother and father born. The kinds of intimacies and love banter that Solomon so indiscriminately showers on the harem are in reality reserved for the beloved. That is the God-given spouse of biblical marriage. And she's on her way back to that life, back to him. Return, return indeed. With this chapter, we see that Shulamith has passed her probation. She's been on probation. Double entendre again. Every virgin was on probation before admitted to the harem to make sure there were no flaws, to make sure she was trainable, to make sure she was fit and suited ultimately for the king, for the bed of the king. So there's that sense she's been on probation in the harem, but how else has she also been on probation, right? She's been on probation before the Lord, too. Will she be true to the model of biblical marriage? Or will she, like so many hundreds of others, fall prey to the seductions of Solomon? Shulamith has passed her probation. Her time of trial and temptation is over. As the Eagles put it, she's already gone. Remember that song, right? Solomon, you're going to have to eat your lunch by yourself. I'm feeling strong. I'll sing this victory song, right? I'm already gone. Many waters and floods have tried to overwhelm her, but to no avail. No more batteries of flatteries will charm and disarm this one. There are turning points, are there not, in the Christian life? There are turning points for all of us. You might come to a point where you say, The bottle is my master. I'm no longer in control. Control, my control, that's an illusion. I need help. If I don't, I'll die. I'm a hopeless alcoholic. I'm going back to God, my family, and my church. That's a turning point, isn't it? Pray to God. Everyone under those circumstances finds that turning point. Or I'm not finding any love really sleeping around. There's no commitment. There's no depth. There's no real intimacy. I'm too afraid of getting hurt to love, really. I'm going back. I'm returning and see if my spouse will take me back. Or I'm utterly lost. I'm disillusioned by what I thought the world would give me. I'm in this rock and roll world. I'm in this harem culture. But it's empty, it's bankrupt, and I'm going to hell. If something doesn't happen, I will go to hell. I'm not listening to what the atheists, the Muslims, or the New Age weirdos have to say anymore. I'm going back. I'm returning to Jesus, the Bible, and my church. Some such things, right? There are turning points in the Christian life. Shulamith has reached such a turning point. She's already gone. My wife has made a valuable contribution to this series. She came in from chores a while back. She listens to the Bible on MP3 and manages to go through the Bible as many as 4 times a year as she goes through her chores and her work on the farm. 4 times a year. How many of us get through the Bible once in a year, right? And she came in one day after finishing Song of Solomon with our understanding of it now. It's always been a mystery wrapped inside an enigma for so long. And she came in and she said in her inimitable way, "You know, Song of Solomon is Solomon's tribute to the one that got away." To the one that got away. Bingo! Shulamith gets away. She does not fall prey to his seductive power. We've seen that Solomon indeed is the author of Song of Solomon. All through the book, Solomon flatters. There's an irony here too. Solomon flatters, but he is not flattered in it. Is he? We see him for what he was in his latter days. A philanderer that will soon turn into an idolater. But in this book, he has this moment of humility and insight where he admits that indeed this beautiful country girl was indeed wiser than the wisest man in history. He is Solomon in decline, slouching towards debauchery and idolatry. She is Shulamith, the female counterpart to the wisest man who ever lived, only much wiser than him at this juncture. She opts for the biblical model of love and marriage. We've seen Solomon and the harem attempt to ensnare her in the vortex of harem life, the way of the world, contemporarily speaking, the culture of rock and roll, if you will. Many of us faced it. Many of our kids are facing it now. But instead of falling prey, becoming ensnared in it, she returns to her village, her mother's room, her shepherd boy. And in returning to that biblical model of marriage, she returns to Christ. Faithful to the model, you will be faithful to Christ is implicit here as well. Right? One church, one Savior. How many churches does Christ have? How many Saviors do we have? Paul calls, indeed, marriage the very mystery of Christ and the church. In being faithful to that biblical model of marriage, Shulamith is, indeed, we can draw a direct connection to her faithfulness to Christ. With this in mind, seeing indeed her faithfully overcome her time of probation in being faithful to Christ, Let us now come and return then to that place of refuge and safety, to the body and blood of Christ, and the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.